Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, today I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. So if you'd like to talk with Susan, give us a call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and owner of the Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes as well as the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois. She's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find Susan on the web at www.eatandmove.com. She also has an office at Strawberry Fields in Urbana. Questions about diet, nutrition, and exercise? They're invited this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Beautiful spring day. Thanks for coming in.
Sure is.
We've already got a couple of listeners ready to talk with you, Susan, so let's go right to the phones. First, we're going to go to Flora, Illinois, line four. Good afternoon. Caller on line four. Hold on. Let's try again. Okay. Line four. Now I think we've snagged you. Hi. Line four? No. How about if we try line one, Henry? We've got another listener waiting to talk with us there on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I heard from a nutritionist, and I don't know if it was you or somebody else, about saying oats were as good as or equivalent to oatmeal for reducing cholesterol. Could you comment on that?
Yes, there have been a lot of studies on oats and cholesterol reduction, mainly because of what you may hear about beta-glucan, which is kind of the gummy fiber that is found in oats and oatmeal. And so there have been a lot of studies on people taking in oatmeal. The amount of oatmeal that you'd have to eat in a day in most of these studies is equivalent to about a cup and a half of cooked oatmeal.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I was wondering if you could compare it with barley. That's what I was
thinking. Okay, sure. Yes, barley as well as oats. Oats has this gummy fiber that I mentioned. Barley also has a gummy type fiber, and you can tell when you cook it up. It kind of looks a bit gummy, kind of like that. Barley has been used in some studies along with other things. I don't know that I've ever seen a study just on barley itself, but because we know it has that type of gummy fiber, certainly it may do the same thing that oats do, and that is kind of bind some of these bile acids that are in the body, which form cholesterol. And so if you bind some of those and take them out of your system when you go to the bathroom, then you won't have as many in your body to begin with. So barley is one of those other types of fibers that we think of it more as soluble. We've got insoluble fiber that's more wheat bran or the type of fiber that helps you stay regular. And then we've got soluble, which is more of this gummy type of fiber, which may help decrease blood cholesterol levels and maybe help with diabetes and some other things as well. So I really encourage people to use barley as a side dish more often. You can certainly cook that up. And if you want a little flavor in it, you cook it up with some chicken bouillon or some vegetable bouillon so you have a little flavor in that. Or use it. We have it often in soups and try to use it more in soups and stews. Many people use barley to make a meatloaf. That's something that you can cook up a little bit first and then add that in as a filler with meatloaf. And so using it as in that way, or maybe mixing it with beans as a side dish is another way just to get a lot of this gummy fiber. Beans are also real high in that type of fiber that may help with blood cholesterol levels as well.
Okay. But there's no, you can't say that oatmeal is as effective as barley and there's no.
Yeah, good question. I don't know that we can say that one is more effective than the other. We have, the bulk of the studies have been on oatmeal.
Okay.
And then, but what we do know is this type of fiber, that beta-glucan, the type of the gummy fiber, does tend to be the thing that we think is probably most effective. And so then we kind of extrapolate and look at other foods that have that same type of gummy fiber, and barley is definitely one of those.
Well, what about, I mean, you're saying eat beans, but what if you're diabetic and beans present a problem?
Well, I think if you're diabetic, beans can certainly be in your plan. You'd want to just know that you'd count the carbohydrate in that as well as, you know, that would be a carbohydrate source for you. But certainly we recommend beans as part of a diabetic diet because for one reason, it may make you feel, they may make you feel more satisfied, so you might not eat as much. And then, of course, we got the fiber, and then you've got protein in the bean with the fiber. So that may help modulate blood sugars as well. So definitely beans are one thing I try to help people incorporate if they are diabetic.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to line four. Henry, this is our Flora caller, and let's see if we can get them on the air here now. Line four, Flora.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes, good to talk to you again. Before I ask my question, I just wanted to say one thing that I've had the pleasure of listening to you now over several months. I've had the pleasure of speaking to you a couple times, and you have been very helpful, very instrumental in helping me bring down my cholesterol, and I want to thank you very much.
Well, great. Good for you. You must be doing everything you're supposed to do, too.
Well, I've listened to you.
That's great.
That helps. Now, my question is this, because in discussions on this with my friends and with other individuals, the question keeps coming up. The reason that we obviously want to get down the LDL and the reason we want to raise the HDL is to prevent the clogged arteries. And as these numbers get better and better, we keep asking the question, is there at some point, if we get the HDL high enough, if we get the LDL low enough, that we could actually see a reversal in the process? And if we have, say, for example, maybe 60% blockage or at some point 50% blockage, if we could look down the road and maybe seeing that reduced to maybe 40 or 30% blockage, because the people I talk to have not been able to give me the answer, and I wondered what you thought.
Well, we have definitely seen this. Like you're saying, if you get your lipids really in order so that you bring down the bad cholesterol quite a bit, you're able to raise your good cholesterol. So lipids are one factor. The main studies that have been done on this very thing have been done by someone you may know, Dean Ornish and his group out in California. And he's got, you know, books on reversing heart disease and so on. He maintains, and I've heard him speak several times, he really talks a lot about how, yes, it's diet. Diet is so important, and he really goes for a very low-fat diet, more like 10% fat or so, and vegetarian, almost solely vegetarian. And he's talked more lately about maybe getting more of these good fats back in the diet, but certainly it's high fruits and vegetables, high fiber, moderate protein, but not too high. The fats that you would have are good fats and primarily vegetarian. But along with that, he really talks a lot about how there are so many other factors that affect this reversal of heart disease, he calls it. And some of that is making sure that you're getting good support, making sure that you're doing yoga or relaxation or meditation. And obviously, you've got a good exercise program. And so he really looks at the whole picture. And those, the studies that have found reversal of this buildup have been in these patients who've been in his complete program, and that would include all the things we just talked about besides diet. And so certainly diet is a big factor in it, but perhaps there's other things that may help relax the arteries, reduce the buildup and things like that. But definitely, I mean, I maintain that I think that people can make, if they can make these changes and be consistent with them, not everyone's going to see major reductions, but, you know, a lot of people are from the studies that we have. And so the biggest thing is really being consistent with that and then thinking about what else reduces your risk.
Would there be any particular target numbers you would think, in your mind, that you would set for, say, We've talked about this in the past, I know, in other regards, but on the HDL and the LDL levels that you would say, now this is truly positive, and I think that this is probably working in your favor, you know, reversing maybe the condition. Is there any numbers that you, in your mind, would think would be probably levels that would bring up that, you know, that you would think that would be occurring?
Well, I don't know that we have those exact numbers. I know from cardiologists I talk to and the research that we have, most people say the lower the better. And so where we used to say LDL at 140, then 130, then 120, and now lower than 100. I had a client who came in the other day, and her cardiologist wants her LDL below 80. And so, I mean, it's getting very, very low. And so I think what we're finding is that for many people, another reduction of 10 milligrams or another 5% reduction may decrease your risk even more. So, and then we do, of course, look at that HDL because it's pretty difficult to move the HDL. Some people will see movements, obviously, from changing their diet. Sometimes if they consistently have alcohol, we might see that go up, actually. So that can be a beneficial thing. Switching the type of fats might increase HDL. But the biggest factor I see is if you're a smoker, you stop. That can affect HDL levels. And then really improving your cardiovascular risk by exercise. And so getting more cardiovascular or aerobic exercise in some people will increase HDL levels as well. But I don't know that we have enough information to say what exact numbers are going to really put you at lower risk. We just know keep moving in the right direction.
You think just look at the whole picture more than anything, and the lower the better on the LDL and higher the better on the HDL, and that's just pretty much the way it has to be looked at?
I think so, and then I think you want to look at everything else you're doing. Again, there are always people who have very low blood lipids, and then they have a heart attack. And so you don't expect that. They've done everything diet-wise, perhaps, and they still have problems or they have a blockage. And so then we start to look at these other things. Again, foods that we've talked about, foods that affect your artery pliability. And do you have a lot of stress in your life? And are you active? Many people are at good body weight, so they're not as active because they don't have to lose weight. But reality, that doesn't decrease your risk then because you're not being cardiovascularly fit. And so I think looking at that big picture is really the most important thing, and then being consistent.
Well, just one other thing along this line, and again, as always, you're very helpful on this. Are there any tests or are there anything that you would recommend an individual who is concerned about this, other than getting the cholesterol numbers and checking the blood pressure and checking the blood sugar and things like this? Are there any other tests or any other checkups you would recommend if someone wants to be just as proactive as they can be?
Well, there are other things that we're looking at, things like homocysteine levels. That's another blood level that isn't always taken, but it's something you could ask your cardiologist about or ask your primary physician about. We know that if homocysteine levels are increased, then that might put you at risk for coronary disease as well. And things like, simple things like B vitamins tend to keep homocysteine levels down. So an across-the-board B vitamin or a multi that has plenty of Bs in it or a good amount of Bs is, of course, something we really recommend, because if that's a simple way to keep your homocysteine levels down, and that's something that might affect cardiovascular disease, it's not too difficult to do that. So that might be one other thing. There's another, you know, there are other lab tests. C-reactive protein is another one that's being looked at. But what I would do is I would ask your physician, can I make sure I have the whole battery of tests? Because there are other things that just aren't taken as a general rule, but in your case, may be really helpful for you to know any other risk factors.
Okay. Well, as always, great information, and I can only say keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Eureka on line two. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Susan. I'd like to know I have a high glucose, and I eat a lot of popcorn. Is that bad?
Well, with high blood sugars or high glucose, what we're finding is that the most important thing is the amount you eat.
Uh-huh.
And so popcorn is another one of these types of foods that's a higher fiber food, which is great. And so it's actually a really good snack. A serving of popcorn is about 3 cups. That's considered a grain serving if you have 3 cups of popcorn.
Uh-huh.
And so that would be, you know, that'd be equivalent to a slice of bread or another grain serving or a half cup of potatoes, something like that, in terms of the amount of carbohydrates. So one thing I find for some people, they just eat so much that it ends up raising their blood sugar because it's just a lot of carbohydrate at one time. And, of course, then you'd want to look at how it's prepared. And if it's low fat or a light version, you're probably in good shape. But there's nothing wrong with popcorn. It's certainly a good addition to the diet. Again, it's high fiber. It's some of this gummy fiber. So it can work in your plan just fine.
What about potatoes? Are they going to increase my sugar?
Well, again, they're a carbohydrate source, so the main thing with potatoes, too, is a serving size.
Uh-huh.
As a general rule, if you're worried about blood sugars, then a good thing to think about is whatever your starch is, if that's potato in a meal or rice or pasta, I encourage people to have a smaller portion of that and about double the size of other vegetables. So Let's say you have a meal, you have chicken, you have half cup potatoes and a full cup of broccoli.
Okay.
That way your total carbs are not that high.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. By the way, we've had a couple of questions here already this afternoon that involve diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to mention that coming up Wednesday morning on Focus 580, in the 10 o'clock hour of Focus on Wednesday, Doyle Moore will be in with David Inge, as he is on the first Wednesday of the month. And their topic this month is cooking for diabetics. And they'll have a dietitian and nutritionist alongside as well.
Great.
On Wednesday. So if you're looking for recipes, if you're concerned about diabetes and you're a diabetic or someone you love and cook for is diabetic, you want to tune in for that Wednesday morning, the 6th of April. Doyle Moore and a dietitian and nutritionist will join David Inge for that program. In the meantime, this afternoon, if you've got questions about diet, nutrition, exercise, you can give us a call. Susan Kundrat is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. If you'd like to talk with Susan, give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment. The one thing that you suggested that maybe we would talk about this afternoon if we needed to fill a little time in between mm-hmm. calls, the role diet plays in maintaining brain sharpness, optimal brain sharpness.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us? This is a great topic.
Right. And I think it's a topic that's going to receive a lot more, just a lot more questions. And people are very interested now about what they can do to just try to remain sharp and try to do what they can to keep their brain healthy. And it kind of goes along with some of the callers we've had today, because really when you look at brain health and what seems to be most important, you really have to look at blood vessels and how you're keeping your blood vessels healthy. Because, of course, if you can keep blood flow to the brain and maintain good blood vessel integrity, then that seems to be a big issue with brain health as well. And so there's a real overlap with cardiovascular health, diet for cardiovascular health, and certainly diet for brain health as well, when you think about the blood vessels. And we know that there's a link with increases in saturated fat in the diet and maybe more problems with Alzheimer's or dementia or those kinds of things. And so if you do have real high lipids, that could be a factor in earlier dementia. I don't think we know this for sure, but there have been some studies to link that as well. And other things that appear to be helpful, we talked about B vitamins too, mm-hmm. with cardiovascular health. And there certainly are studies on making sure you're getting plenty of B vitamins, particularly folate, vitamin B6, and vitamin B12. I've seen a lot of people who have been low in vitamin B12. They're not taking it in a supplemental form, and that's just in animal foods. And so if somebody is, particularly if they're vegetarian, or as we get older, we don't absorb vitamin B12 very well. And so certainly over age 50, everybody should be getting, not that that's old, but everybody should be getting at least a multivitamin that contains B vitamins. And again, most of them do contain 100% of folate, B6, and B12. But we do know that we absorb it better from a supplemental form than regular food. That's another reason to think about, okay, are we absorbing vitamins and minerals and the nutrients from food as well as we get old? We know that we generally don't. And so looking at other ways like yogurt, we've talked about, or other ways to get good bacteria into the diet on a daily basis that may help us absorb these nutrients may certainly be helpful for our brain health too, because if we know we've got to have these nutrients in the system, we've got to find a way to make sure they actually get absorbed. And we talked about homocysteine levels as one thing that's actually looked at with cardiovascular, and it appears that with Alzheimer's, homocysteine levels are often elevated as well. And so again, the B vitamins tend to be the nutrients that may keep this blood level down of homocysteine. And so, you know, if you look at foods that are high in B vitamins, a lot of grains and cereals and things are fortified, but nuts and legumes and if you look at something like folates, real high with orange juice and dark green leafy vegetables and those kinds of things. Probably if there was, you know, one food I'd recommend, you know, when you're looking at trying to get a lot of these nutrients, it would have to be something like spinach or kale or these dark green leafies, because again, it's going to be real high in B vitamins. And so that's something we're finding out too. And we hear a lot about antioxidants. You know, there have been a lot of controversial studies lately about vitamin E. Should you take extra vitamin E? Should you not? Is it helpful or harmful? And studies that look at vitamin E and vitamin C, both with brain health or look at decreased risk of dementia, find that those people who get more C and E, at least in their diet, tend to have lower risk of dementia. So there certainly appears to be a role of these antioxidants in the diet. I encourage people, you know, our recommended intake for vitamin C is maybe 75 to 90 milligrams a day, depending upon who you are. But really, I think you should try to get double that at least in food. And that's not that hard to do. If you get a serving of strawberries and 6 ounces of orange juice and maybe a half a potato in a day, you're probably getting 200 milligrams of vitamin C. So really the key there is more fruits and vegetables, because okay, that's high.
So another way to think about it is you want stuff that really packs a punch, nutrient dense.
Right.
And lower on the calorie end.
Exactly, exactly.
So fruits and vegetables.
Definitely. I mean, more fruits and vegetables. And then when you're looking at getting some of these fats, also we find a lower risk with more fish fat. And it appears that omega-3s and fat from fish certainly may help our brain in terms of looking at people lower risk for having kind of down days and maybe lower risk for dementia as well. So there may be something to do with omega-3s and fatty fish and even things like nuts and seeds and avocado and these good fats that we think of for cardiovascular health may be really important for brain health as well.
Yeah. Couple of things before we take the next call here. You know, there has been concern, as you noted, about, you know, you can get too much vitamin E in a supplement.
Right.
It's been controversial. Also, you can get too much of other vitamins, including the B vitamins. So that's something you don't want to overdo,
right,
in supplements. The other question I had for you about supplements, you said B12 is something you really want to look for in a multivitamin supplement,
mm-hmm,
or on its own with other Bs.
Right.
But and you said that's a really important, you know, that's a powerhouse supplement. That's really good. And I'm wondering about omega-3 supplements.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thinking there? Because there, some folks are concerned about eating the fattier fishes, and also some people don't eat fish.
Right, right. Omega-3 supplementation certainly has been recommended for a lot of different concerns. Everything from been real helpful with people with arthritis, and again, it may be helpful with depression and a lot of other things besides cardiovascular health too. So generally omega-3 supplementation, if it's 1 to 3 grams per day, that appears to be in a very safe range. And of course, this is omega-3s are a blood thinner. And so if you're on any other medication that could affect blood thinning, anything like that, you want to talk with your doctor just to make sure this doesn't become a problem for you. But I've read so much more about omega-3s and the supplementation with that too. And it's just, even if you eat a lot of fish, it's hard to get it in. Now, another place you can get omega-3s if you're vegetarian or you don't eat fish is looking at flax oil and looking at ground flax seeds.
Okay.
Start adding some of those in, and you get some omega-3s in nuts and seeds, and especially looking at nuts that are more monounsaturated, like walnuts and almonds and things like that. So there are some things you can do, and I do think that this is something that we're just going to find in even minute amounts of getting more omega-3s in these good fats, probably a lot of benefit in a lot of different areas.
Okay, let's talk with another listener in Mattoon, line 4. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I was wondering about the flaxseed. I like to use it on my cereal. Should it be cooked? Should I put it in with the oats and the water before I microwave the oatmeal, or should I wait and put it on after I've cooked the cereal?
I would put it on after you cook the cereal. I would, if you use flax, for those of you who haven't used flax, it's just a small seed. You can get these regular brown seeds or golden flax, or it doesn't appear to be a big difference nutritionally in either one. But the most bioactive way, or probably the way that you could utilize the nutrients best, is if you buy the whole seeds. If you grind them yourself, as soon as
Well, I may have been making a mistake because I've been buying it already ground.
Well, buying it ground is okay, too. You may
keep it in the freezer.
Right, which is great. You'd want to keep that in the freezer. If you can grind it yourself, fine. If you can't and it's already ground, that's exactly what you want to do because it does have a lot of this fat in it. You want to do just like you're doing. Keep it in the freezer. Keep it tightly sealed. And then take out a tablespoon or two and use that. And I would put it in after. Certainly you can use flax in, cooking and things. Some people think, well, maybe it loses a little bit of its usability. But I would just throw it in after if that works for you. And that would be great.
Okay. Thank you. How about the losing nutritional value in a fruit that you, a fresh fruit like an orange or a kiwi, that you cut and slice, oh, I've got too much, I'll save that and eat that tomorrow. Does it lose its any of its value, does light and that sort of thing cause it to deteriorate?
Well, you'll lose some if it's open to air. That's the biggest issue. So what I would do is if you have fresh fruit, then I would throw a little bit of orange juice over it and cover it tightly. And then have it the next day. That's why we often, add a little lemon juice or orange juice to cut up apples or something to keep them from browning. Really what it's doing is keeping it from losing some of the nutrients, too.
I see. Well, that's very interesting. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. I'm thinking about a bowl of oatmeal.
Yeah, it sounds good, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? With some almonds on top.
That's right.
Maybe some raisins.
A little bit of flax in there, too.
Yeah, okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat, our guest this afternoon here on the program. If you've got a question about diet, nutrition, or exercise, give us a call. Talk to Susan. She'll help you out. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. How does dried fruit compare with fresh?
Well, dried fruit, many of the dried fruits are high in nutrients. Certainly raisins are, and if you look at dried apricots and those kinds of things, the biggest difference really is the calories. Because they're dried and they're dehydrated, they lose their fluid, so they're pretty dense in calories in small amounts. So you might throw a handful in, and that might be the same calories as a big orange. Because it just doesn't have the fluid. And so the biggest thing to be aware of is the amount that you have. It's kind of like nuts and seeds, that they're really good for you, but you don't want to eat too many or they're going to be really high in calories, and that might prevent you from keeping your weight on, at a normal, healthy level and things. But dried fruit can be really helpful as an addition, and it's just so portable that it's great to take with you, too.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about fish oil and to ask if you had ever heard of fish oil being helpful for eczema. I had a chronic case for several years of eczema on my feet and hands and read somewhere about fish oil for that and began taking a capsule that is, it has organic flax, borage, and cold water fish oils. And it took about 6 months to resolve, but I no longer have the eczema. It hasn't been back for about over a year now, and I just wondered if you'd heard anything about dealing with eczema with fish oil capsules, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Okay.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's great that worked for you, and certainly that's something that we do look at for eczema that helps some people. And so when you think about the fish oil and just these good fats as well, that they may decrease inflammation, that's where it tends to have a helpful effect with a lot of different concerns in the body. And so certainly if you've got any kind of skin-related concern, we look at that because it may keep your skin healthier. Certainly it may help with the fatty acids that's needed. Anytime there's dryness, we look at adding essential fats that may be helpful with that too. So that's fabulous that worked. And you bring up a really good point in that for a lot of concerns, we really have to use something consistently and long enough to get it into your system and have your body have enough on board maybe to do what it needs to do. And so it's really good that you're patient, because I think that's one thing that often somebody will do something for a month or so and we won't see any results. Well, maybe you would if it were a bit longer. And so that's really good. But I just got interviewed on this not that long ago in terms of what might be helpful for, skin health, and certainly omega-3 fats are definitely something we look at, too.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line two. Good afternoon.
Me and my wife had a baby about 4 months ago. We're both vegetarians, and my wife thinks it's a really bad idea to give that kind of diet to our daughter. I was just wondering about your thoughts on that issue.
Well, I think what you want to look at, and certainly people raise their kids vegetarian, and do it, if you do it correctly, you can be in really good shape. Sometimes there are additional supplements that your baby may need that another one wouldn't need. Particularly, you look at something, of course, you know, iron becomes something that you look at anyway with a baby in terms of making sure they're, once their stores are low, that they're getting enough, and making sure they're getting enough protein and other nutrients that might be really important. Some of that depends on if you're totally vegan. Are you totally vegan?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay.
We eat fish.
So if you eat fish and use milk products and those kinds of things, it's very easy to get your baby everything that that he or she would need, particularly as they get a little bit older. So it's not difficult to do. It's just a matter of making sure you have a plan so you really know how to substitute different things and making sure that that's not a problem. And again, it might be that because there are certain nutrients like iron that you might have real trouble getting in, may need some type of, make sure the child is on some type of just, again, 100% supplement or that kind of thing, as well as what you're doing nutrition-wise. But one of my best friends is a dietitian, has raised both of her boys vegetarian, although they do use milk as well and fish. And so she's done it without much problem at all. And so you can certainly do it.
Great. So it's just as well if you do it the right way.
Right, sure. And the thing that I would make sure you do is that I'd make sure, whether that's from a book or you're meeting with a dietitian, you're finding out exactly what your child would need. So, you know, it is different from an adult because there are certain nutrients that are so crucial for brain development and cell development that you wouldn't want to be low the first couple years. It's such a crucial time for development that you really want to, you know, not expect that your child will just eat like you do. There may be specific things needed early on that you want to make sure you don't leave out.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Next, we talk with a listener in McLean County on line 3. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, and I'll start with one, and if we have time, I'll ask the second one. I have a friend who's a vegetarian. I'm not. But she, in my opinion, the other thing about her is that she has a problem with depression and anxiety, and I just don't think she's getting enough protein. Because she's a vegetarian with no fish and no meat of any kind. I think she does have some milk and yogurt, or actually has yogurt, but not milk. But have you heard of anything in terms of protein intake affecting or not affecting depression or anxiety disorder or any other mental illness?
Well, probably more so than protein. And we've kind of touched on this. We do see sometimes problems with fatty acid deficiency or not getting enough fat, which sometimes is a problem for vegetarians.
Uh-huh.
Not always, but sometimes if you're not eating meats and you're not getting the fat that comes along with those meats, it might be low. But if you're not eating fish or if you're not getting other things in, and certainly protein, when you think about what protein does, it helps with alertness. It helps, you know, we certainly have studies if kids get more protein in the morning, they tend to do better in school because mm-hmm. they can think more clearly and those kinds mm-hmm. of things. And all that affects depression, too. So there certainly could be a role in that with if protein is low.
You haven't seen any studies on that yet, have you?
I don't know that I've seen anything on that specifically, but okay. It certainly makes sense
right,
that
yeah.
protein, if it is low, then you're not going to have tissue development the way you would, or you may not repair as well, and that can affect everything in the body.
Okay.
And so that can definitely be a factor. And I think with vegetarians, even if she's having some milk products, some yogurt and things, she could probably meet her needs, mm-hmm. but she'd have to make sure she's using some vegetarian substitutes, some soy type substitutes, meat substitutes, things like that, more beans and peas and mm-hmm. and nuts and seeds and nut butters. And again, you can do it. You just
right,
need
yeah.
to make sure everything
yeah.
is in there and that you're eating enough. I
right.
find sometimes what affects depression, too, with clients I've had is that they're just not eating enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so their total intake is low, their energy is low, and sometimes if we can boost their fuel so that they actually just feel better because they're getting enough energy, they're getting enough nutrients, that really helps with the depression too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm glad to hear that because I wanted to talk to her about that. I just thought it'd be nice, and I've been waiting for you to be on. So I could ask you and say, well, I heard a dietitian tell me this. The other question real quickly, That is, but you were just talking about, and I got on just only 10 minutes ago listening to you, so I missed the first half hour. But if you have mentioned, like, the flaxseed, and how about flaxseed oil? And if you want to go get the omega-3 fish oil, I mean, what should I look for brand-wise? Because I use the flaxseed oil pills. They're like 1,000 milligrams. I don't know the oil capsules,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if they're good enough.
Right.
Or if I should, you know, I don't know if I want to do the flaxseed itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
right.
Because I used to do certain things and I get tired of it. You know, it's like if I didn't have a way to mix it or whatever, and then you get tired of eating the same thing all mm-hmm. the time kind of thing. So... Or if you get the fish oil pill, what should I look for in the pill or the capsule?
Well, one thing you might want to look at, one of the really good resources that's out there, and you can then kind of compare brands and things, is Consumer Lab. It's a website that they do outside testing of mm-hmm. dietary supplements, and it's just www.consumerlab.com
mm-hmm.
and they have a listing of omega-3 fatty acid supplements and things, and you can kind of compare different ones, how much is in them. It gives a little review at the beginning, and it'll give you examples of ones that have passed their tests. One of the big concerns with omega-3s and with fish is mercury. Is something contaminated? You know, some fish we find are contaminated with mercury, or there's too much mercury.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a problem periodically with fish supplements too, or fish oil supplements. So this is a good review that kind of goes through different companies that have been tested and things like that. And so that might be a good place for you to start to kind of look. But many people find that they would rather have flax oil in a supplemental form like you're doing, because it's just easier than mixing it with other things or taking
mm-hmm.
that. And, of course, if you compare flax oil to flax seeds,
mm-hmm.
the flax seeds have the oil in them too, just not as much. You're going
right.
to have a lot more fibers and other things in the seeds, but, of course, the oil is going to be straight
right.
fatty acids.
And with flax seed, how much do you recommend? Because I think I heard you say 1 to 3 grams for the omega-3.
Right. Generally omega-3 type supplements or oils are tolerated well in most people up to 3 grams a day, and certainly many people more than that. And in many instances, people take a lot more than that for their concerns, but kind of as a general in most studies. And so, you know, most people I find, if they're going to take it, they probably take within that range. And certainly it's up to you and what you're kind of looking for. But
flaxseed oil?
Right, and flaxseed oil would be as part of that. You know, would be considered part of those essential fatty oils or omega-3 type oils.
Okay. Oh, so if I were just taking the flaxseed oil capsule instead of omega-3, I'd still probably need to be between 1 and 3.
Yeah, I mean, that's what most of the studies find to be beneficial, as well as not too much.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Any contraindications for flaxseed or flaxseed oil?
Well, when you look at flaxseed too, and any type of oil like that, again, mm-hmm. it could potentially affect blood thinning. And so that's something that you always want to think about. And I think any time, just as a general guideline, any time we're taking something that's more than kind of the basic recommended intake, if you're thinking of it as a therapeutic dose of something, like, again, many people use fish oil therapeutically, use it to decrease inflammation, to help with arthritis, that kind of thing. Think about it as a drug. I mean, because that's really what you're doing. And so you're using larger amounts to be used as a drug. And so you want to think, how does that affect any other medications? How does that affect, what are the side effects, because you're getting larger amounts in? And so is this going to decrease the absorption of other things? I've been working on a big article on specific herbs and athletes and exercise. And it's been really interesting and challenging, the whole side effect area, because some herbs we know a lot about the side effects, and some we don't. And so trying to figure out how much is enough but not too much, and what the studies really say, and what could be potential side effects, is a real challenge. And so, but I think it's just always important, if you're thinking about something therapeutically, you also need to think, what could be the side effects, because I'm using a larger amount of that.
So talk with your physician and your pharmacist.
Definitely.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 4 in Seidel. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Going back to heart health and cholesterol lowering, could you talk about the use of some simple soy addition? What would you buy, and would that not be a good thing to do? And I just have generally gotten the idea that soy was a good thing, but I'd like to know how to do it in an easy way.
Mm-hmm. Well, soy, we've got a lot of studies on soy that it may also help decrease blood cholesterol levels. It may not decrease the levels as much as we first thought from early studies, but certainly it may be helpful. And the general recommendation is up to 25 grams a day of soy protein. It really appears to be the soy protein that is most helpful with cholesterol reduction. So if you look at different labels of things, let's say if you're getting, you know, a simple way to add soy is veggie burger, let's say, for instance, and that might have, you might have one with 7 or 10 grams of soy protein. That's a simple way. Another way that you could do it is add soy milk or soy yogurt or soy cheese or some of those things that are already prepared that also have soy protein in them. Or use miso, which is kind of a paste that you can use as a soup base, and that's a good way to kind of get a little bit of soy in there too. Another really simple thing is to think about using soybeans in place of regular beans. Let's say you make chili or you make soup or you're making beans and rice or anything you might use beans in, you could use canned soybeans. You could use frozen edamame, which is the soy bean too that's frozen. And so those are all kind of simple ways to start adding soy in. And, of course, we think of tofu. You know, one of the easiest ways that a lot of people like tofu to start using it is to buy the real firm tofu and to put that in a little bit of maybe soy sauce or even pineapple juice and soy sauce. You could marinate it in and then kind of bake it like that so it gets firm. And it's got a little flavor to it that way. You know, it'll take on any type of flavor you use for it. And so that's a real easy way to say, well, I'm not going to have chicken, but I'm going to have this baked tofu. And use, again, the more firm tofu so it's a little bit firmer when you eat it. So that's an easy way, too, to kind of start using soy. But I think a lot of people start with soy milk or soy yogurt or, you know, ways that they might normally eat something anyway. And they replace that with something with soy or made from soybeans, too. The other thing that's real easy to do with soy that I've done quite a bit is if you take what you'll see in the market as TVP, or textured vegetable protein, or TSP, textured soy protein. It's just really the dry soybeans. And you can take those soy flakes and you can put them in warm water and have them soften, and then you can add that to anything. Meatloaf, you can add that to soup, meatballs, anything like that.
Spaghetti sauce.
Spaghetti sauce is an easy one, yeah. And so that way you're getting the protein, but it's soy protein. And it's really inexpensive way to add it, too. It's very... Very inexpensive, so that might be another good thing you could try. I encourage people to start maybe if they're trying to add soy consistently, maybe one serving a day for a couple weeks, get used to that, then maybe two servings a day for a couple weeks. Three servings of typical servings of soy is about 25 grams, depending upon what you've got. But so you wouldn't want to add it all at once. You might have trouble with gas or bloating or just your body may not be used to handling it or breaking it down.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Also, I think, does the University of Illinois have a pamphlet or a cookbook on soy?
Right. They've got actually a lot of things. The Center for Soy Foods here at the U of I don't have that website handy, but you could get on the University of Illinois website and just search that, Center for Soy Foods. And they've got handouts. They've also got great recipe books, cookbooks that they've put out that have really easy-to-use recipes that have been reviewed by a dietitian there, and it really a good resource. And another one you might want to look at is just a real simple website, just www.soyfoods.com. And that's, they've got a lot of, you know, I think it's a U.S. Soybean Association. They've got a lot of information on soy foods. They've got some other things you can download and print off and recipes and tips and things like that as well.
Okay. We can get one more call in here if we're quick about it. So let's take this last call this afternoon. Caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Oh, hi. There seems to, you were talking about firm tofu. What about tempeh? That seems to be under everybody's radar, and we eat that quite a bit and really like it.
Yeah, great idea. I forgot about tempeh, but tempeh is a little bit, it's, if you see in the store, it's more like a harder, it's a hard brick. Yeah. And
yeah.
It works great to saute. And again, you can marinate that and use it. And it's actually, it's good that you brought that up because it's actually more concentrated soy protein than tofu. How do you use it?
Well, we use it in a stir fry, but we usually will cut it up into small bite-sized pieces and put a little bit of an edge on it. And it's very chewy, and it really takes the place of meat in that respect. So, and when I talk about it, almost everybody gives me a blank stare.
Yeah, I don't think it's been used as much, but it works out really well. In most of the stores now, you can buy a lot of flavored tempeh as well as tofu. So that's a good idea as well.
Well, we she's got started eating it in Indonesia, so I'm guessing it's a Southeast Asian style of tofu.
Right, and it is a more fermented, which is great, and that there may be definitely additional benefits to that. So it's another good addition.
Okay, and that would be in the market near the tofu, right?
Right. Usually the tempeh would be in the refrigerated section. Usually find that in refrigerated section.
Okay, very good. Well, there we'll have to wrap it up. We've used the time. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll see you in May.
May, hard to believe.
Okay. Susan Kundrat, she joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. She is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. And again, if you're interested in cooking for diabetics, that's the topic of the program Wednesday morning on Focus 580 at 10:06 Central Time. Doyle Moore will be in with David Inge, and they'll have a dietitian and nutritionist with them as well. Cooking for Diabetics, Focus 580, Wednesday morning at 10:06. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Hey, you know, just because I happen to work for University of Illinois Extension and the College of ACES, along with working here with WILL, part of my job is to know websites like the soyfoodsillinois.uiuc.edu that Susan wanted to get to but couldn't come up with. I had that one in the top of my mind. Checked it out, made sure it was right. So the address she was looking for is www.soyfoodsillinois, that's all one word, .uiuc.edu. Most of the University of Illinois sites happen to end with that domain name, which is University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.uiuc, and then .edu, which stands for, of course, education. Let's take a look, speaking of education, at how the traders in Chicago educated themselves about the numbers and the way the market should have gone today. This is the way the finish was at the Board of Trade for the soft red winter wheat in the May contract. The high today, 323, the low at 315, their settlement price 316.5. They were down 6 cents at the day. July futures 331.5, the high, and the low at 324. July, your harvest month, of course, 325.25. They were down 7.75 on the day. And September 337, the high, the low at 331.5, settlement price at 332, down 7.25. And the December contract 346, the high, the low at 340, settled 340.5, and they were down 6 cents for the day. March contract, 352, the high, the low at 348, settlement price there at $3.48 a bushel for the March wheat. That's next year's contract, down 5.5 cents. And the wheat was really the only big loser for the day in the grains floor. Corn was down 2 to 3 cents for the day. May futures, 211.75, the high, the low at 209.5 in the May contract, and a settlement price at 209.75 for that nearby, down 3 cents today. July futures off 3 as well. 220, the high, the low at 217.75, a settlement price there at 218, and September futures, 227, the high, the low at 225, settlement price at $2.25.75, down 2.25. December contract, 235.5, the high for the day, the low at 234, settled 235, they were down 2. And the March contract, 241.75, the high, low at 241, settled 241.25, down 2.25. May futures in the corn pit now, 245.5, this is next year's contract, by the way, 244.75, the low, and the settlement price for the May corn of next year, 2006, 244.75, and they were down 2 cents for the day. May oats up a penny and a quarter, 155.25, the settlement price, with a high at 56.5, the low at 153. July oats, $1.53.25, the high, the low at 150.25. And they settled at 152.5. They were up 2.75 for the day. Soy complex now 620.5. The nearby May contract traded two for a high today. The low at $6.10, settled 615. They were up a penny. July futures were off today, 627 the high, the low at 616 on this Monday afternoon. July settled at $6.22 a bushel in the bean pit, down a penny and a half for the day. August futures, 624.5 the high, the low at 615. Settled 618.5. They were down 1.5. And September's 612.5, the high, the low at 603, settled 607. They were up 3/4 for the day. November futures, this is the harvest month, 607, the high, the low at 596. New crop November beans, 601.5, up a penny and a quarter at the end of this Monday afternoon. January futures for next year, 608, the high, the low at 599, settled $6.02 a bushel, and they were unchanged on the day. May bean meal, 184.50, the high, the low at 182. Settled 183.20, they were down 60 cents. And July bean meal off 60 as well, 186.60, the high, the low at 183.50. And a settlement price at 185.10, they were down 60 for the day. Bean oil futures now, 23.05, the high, the low at 22.48, settled 22.80. They were up 12, and July bean oil, 23.23, the high, the low at 22.68. Settlement price there at 23.06, and they finished the day up 17. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Okay, Todd, lower day today on the Merc. April feeder cattle, 109.85, the high, the low 108.75. The settlement, 108.77.5, that down 32.5. May, 106.75, the high, 105.10, the low 105.30, the settlement, that down 55. August feeders, 108.50, the high, 107.05, the low, the settlement, 107.55, down 65. April live cattle, 90.20, the high, 88.55, the low, 88.77.5, the settlement, that down 95. June live cattle, 85.95, the high, 84, even the low, the settlement, 84.12.5, that down 130. April lean hogs, 70.42.5, the high, 69.25, the low, the settlement, 69.55, down 60. May, 79, even the high, 77.10, the low, 77.92.5, the settlement, that down 67.5. June, 81.55, the high, 79.60, the low, 79.85, the settlement, that down 95. July lean hogs, 80.40, the high, the low, 78.90, the settlement, 79.42.5, that down 15. And May bellies, 96.85, the high, 94.27.5, the low, the settlement, 94.40, that down 252.5. The Dow is up 25 points at 10,430. The NASDAQ up 6 at 1991. The S&P 500 up 3 at 1176.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Michael from Andalusia, Alaska writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do girls like boys more when they're not being noisy?"
Girls are especially sensitive in the hearing department. Boys, on the other hand, can't transmit and receive information at the same time. So when a boy is being noisy, he experiences tranquility. A boy hooting and hollering in an echoey space may visualize himself in a tranquil meadow, offering dandelions to a unicorn. So among other things, girls may be seen as the missing feedback loop to a boy's hearing. Girls who find boys painfully noisy have a great job ahead of them, because not only do they have to make the boy aware of the sonic damage he's inflicting, they have to make him want to do something about it, when clearly he isn't the one suffering. This requires great persuasive skill, which is probably why so many grown-up girls do well in real estate.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember,